You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Mike Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. We're here this afternoon with Grill Marcus, author of Lipstick Traces, A Secret History of the 20th Century, published by Harvard University Press. The book takes up a lot of territory. It covers, I guess, first punk, and then Dada, then the Situationist and Lettrist movements in France, or as they became international movements internationally, as well as a history of religious heresy, blasphemies of different sorts, teenagers, rock music. God, a lot of things go into this book, and it's not a surprise because Grill Marcus wrote perhaps the pioneering pop culture study, Mystery Train, published by Dutton, still available in paperback, with essays, among others, on Elvis Presley and Randy Newman. The Presleyad essay, still a classic of rock criticism. This book, Lipstick Traces, was many years in the preparation. How long had you been working on this?
I guess it took about 9 years, and one of the reasons it took so long was that I started out with just an impulse to write a book about punk with no real idea of what that would mean or where it would go or even what it would really be about. And I stumbled onto connections other people had written about but not developed in any way that was particularly interesting. Punk is like Dada. Punk has something to do with these people called the Situationists, who I'd never heard of. And so I began to read and poke around, do research, and that took a long time. It took a long time, particularly in the case of the Situationists, who were basically a group of Europeans in the 50s and 60s, to find their material, to track it down. Most of it was untranslated. Most of what I was most interested in was untranslated, so I had to learn how to become a translator. And all of that took a long time. And then because this material was so foreign to me, because it is so un-American, it is about avant-gardes, it's about small groups fantasizing they can make history. It's not about populism, it's not about equality, American themes. It took me a long time to get a handle on it.
It's a very moving book, and I would say for me a very upsetting one. Pulled me apart reading it, because as I read, I encountered versions of many kinds of ideology and sloganizing very dear to my heart that kind of disappeared for me, particularly the Situationist notion of turning a city into an adventure, of demanding the freedom to make the place where you live a place in which one's heart desire surrounds you, a fond dream that I still find myself seeking to fulfill. In what ways do the Situationists play into the punk movement?
Well, they play in numerous ways. We could talk about making the city into a terrain of adventure and surprise. There's a way in which that dream and its defeat in May 68, which the Situationists so greatly affected with their ideas and their slogans and their poetry, the defeat of that dream, or its trashing by history, turns into punk years later in the negative, when the Sex Pistols and then many other British punk groups begin to sing about the city as a terrain of boredom and oppression and control and ugliness. But more substantively, I think, it has to do with the way a tiny group of would-be avant-garde artists, would-be revolutionary theorists, small groups of people coming together in Paris in the early 50s and then getting a little bigger, attracting comrades from around Europe in the mid-50s, the way they developed a voice, a vehement, intransigent, seductive, fantasized, all-powerful voice in their critical writings, which I think was passed on to the Sex Pistols, and which in a strange way they realized and made more forceful and more powerful than it had ever been before. So to me it's a matter of seeing the way a voice travels through history more than specific goals, specific ideas. You could almost say what's remarkable, if it's true, the situationist voice found its realization in the Sex Pistols. What's remarkable is that so many ideas that they pursued over the years had nothing to do with the Sex Pistols. That it was not the ideology, it was not the theory, it was the voice.
That voice is, as you say, a thrusting, intransigent voice. What are some of the famous situationist slogans?
Well, most of the slogans that came out of May 68 in one way or another either came out of situationist manifestos, critical essays, black humor articles, or were simply invented by them in the moment. And they include everything from those who talk about revolution without referring explicitly to everyday life, and so on, have corpses in their mouth. That to me is the toughest one because of that wonderful metaphor of a corpse in your mouth.
They were famous also for very destructive adjectives like bidet scraping as a description of personal style.
Right, right. Well, bidet scraping was actually a description of a person they didn't like. Uh-huh. He's merely a bidet scraping. I thought that was just untoppable, except there's one other, maybe even better. It's coagulated undertaker's mute.
I once heard Carol Eastman, the author of Five Easy Pieces, say to someone, "You creeping foreskin," and I thought, well, yes, here's the situationist. Then Dada becomes a second thrust in the what would you call it? This sort of mysterious time travel that culminates in a movement called punk. Dada also has its elements of revulsion as well. How does Dada fit?
Well, again, this is a connection I simply read about as a fan reading, say, New Musical Express from London and reading lots of articles saying, oh, punk is like Dada. Well, for someone like me who knew virtually nothing about Dada, this sounded kind of interesting. And what was meant by that were some very formal art historical parallels. In other words, the Dadaists were famous for attacking the audience and addressing their audiences with spleen and disdain and even spitting. Well, punks did the same thing. Isn't that interesting? And the Dadaists attacked the art of their time as worthless and were called anti-art. And punks attacked rock and roll, their own culture, as worthless, as a fraud, and were often considered anti-rock. Well, again, isn't that interesting? Well, really, it isn't that interesting. Those are the kinds of parallels that really take you nowhere. But as I began to look into Dada, I found something, as many people have before me, something of absolute fascination and mystery. I was looking at the Cabaret Voltaire, the nightclub in Zurich where Dada was begun in 1916, and also looking at Berlin, where Dada became very politicized, very violent. I was not looking at France. I was not looking at other places where Dada also existed. And I found myself following the story of one of the Dadaists, Richard Hulsenbeck, who later became a psychoanalyst. And I was, I think, so attracted to him because, unlike all the rest of them, he was not an artist. He was a noisemaker. He was someone who got up on stage and made trouble.
The Dada drummer.
He was the Dada drummer. He was not an artist, but he played a big bass drum. And he believed in what he called negergedichte, Negro poems. Which he thought were like ragtime. I'm sure they weren't. But what appealed to me about this once I began to find my way into it was the idea that, yes, people in the Cabaret Voltaire were struggling toward the same definition or anti-definition of the conditions of modernity that the Sex Pistols and the punks were in London, but that they were using completely different tools. They were coming from completely different backgrounds. And it seemed to me, though, they were talking to each other. I wanted to write a book where I would render the Cabaret Voltaire with all the drama and all the intensity that I could, bringing out its excitement, bringing out its stupidities, so that a reader could almost superimpose what went on in this nightclub with what went on in punk nightclubs and say, yes, here's a place where the Dadaists went to places that the punks never even knew about, but here's a place where the punks went so far beyond Dada. And so there would be this conversation developing. So it's not a question of influences. It's not a question of the traces in this book, Lipstick Traces, are not traces of influence. They're traces left on a wall that someone might walk along and be struck by. They're that kind of traces. They're little explosions in the memory.
That kind of affront, the impulse to affront, Jarry had written what he called his song to make the niggers blush. Begins, one thing bugs me black, got no nookie in my sack. Hosenbeck's, going on with the nigger gedicta, is following a tradition of, what would you call it? A kind of anti-racism, a racism in burlesque. How does the impulse to affront meet the racist impulse here?
Well, I don't know that it does. I mean, when I said nigger gedicta, it's really negger gedicta. It's German. The word nigger doesn't come into it. It's just Negro. Hulsenbeck was one of the early white Negroes. He was an early, he was like so many people in our own time, so many white people who wanted to sing like black people, who wanted to live like black people. Well, he just wanted to make that poetry, and he had no idea what Negro poetry was. And it happened that the owner of the Cabaret Voltaire was an old sailor who spent a lot of time in Africa and told him, this is nonsense. This isn't the kind of poetry that Negroes make, Africans make. You're out of your mind. And Hulsenbeck said, well, show me something authentic. Show me something real. So the cabaret owner came back with a few scribblings, and out of that, Hulsenbeck began to make sound poetry, poetry that just of sounds. It had no specific meaning. It had no real words or signifiers in them. You would throw the words out there, and maybe they'd turn into signifiers. Maybe they wouldn't.
But I'm talking about, in the Jarry poem or in the Hulsenbeck or going on to punk, a kind of ecstatic xenophobia that turns up, and maybe I'm being an apologist for it.
Okay, I think maybe I didn't see what you meant before. Maybe I can answer you this way. In movements in culture, movements in politics that want to negate, that want to show that the world is not as it seems, that other things are possible, that everything is possible, it's a very thin line between that and nihilism, which can either mean that the world is nothing, or meaning you just don't care. You don't care what the consequences of your acts are going to be. You don't care what the sources of your desires are. You're just going to blow up in public. Now, when you have that kind of impulse, the impulse to do that, the first voice that any of us will grasp is usually a voice of sexism, racism, hatred for the other. That's the most automatic voice that we carry within us to affront, to be ugly, to be negative. And that comes out first. If you're lucky, it's not the only thing that comes out. The Sex Pistols never sang about hating blacks. They never sang about hating foreigners. But the loathing in their music almost automatically inspired plenty of their followers to do just that.
Can there be said to have been a punk movement in America?
Sure.
Because sure. I was noticing, I moved here around then, 74, 72, and I kept meeting, you know, members of bands like the Mau Maus with members whose names were Tiffany and Shannon, you know, who were Beverly Hills girls, who already seemed, even first generation, to be imitations, to be very provocative copies of something that had begun elsewhere. Well, can this impulse that you're talking about, how does it arise globally? What spreads it?
That's a hard question. And it's one of the most remarkable things about contemporary culture, that something will happen in one place, and then it will be, if it strikes a chord in people's hearts or in their minds, it will be all over the world very quickly. What happened here in the United States, you said, was there a punk movement here? I said, yes. Then I began to think, maybe there was, maybe there were only scenes. Maybe there were only gatherings of people playing a music that excited them, that inspired them, that gave them a kind of free speech, gave them a kind of license to say what they wanted to say, find out what it was, have fun with it, but not necessarily to connect it to anything bigger. Well, it was connected to something bigger in England for a short time, and in many other places around the world, many other scenes, many other movements. But America is a different kind of country than England. It's bigger, for one thing. It's 1,000 times more diffuse. And there could be a scene in London that could be replicated all over England, and it would be coherent in a way that a scene in Los Angeles is not going to be coherent in terms of a scene in Cleveland.
Well, it was interesting, and again, to work from personal experience, and I guess one of the triumphs of this book, Lipstick Traces by Grill Marcus, published by Harvard University Press and brand new, is that it is a personal book, an attempt to rest into language and, when necessary, to flounder, sometimes to ejaculate and exclaim. There's a real, you know, kind of jiving with criticism going on here, that there's going to be an adventure, some hypothetical scenes are invented, but working from personal experience, I remember, you know, my apartment in those days were filled with guys, you know, who used to like to go to UCLA to look at pictures of thalidomide babies and burn patients, and I'll never, I guess, forget, even with some sentimentality, a bunch of strung-out kids, junkies, in my house visiting, playing Scrabble and calling out things like, how do you spell pain? How do you spell died? Like what you did to your hair, or what, you know, Shannon did right when she fell off the roof. And thinking, God, you know, something really has transformed. I mean, this is a level of craziness, exaltation, but also bum-outedness that I'd never seen before. You know, that there was something that was not going to come to the rescue of these kids the way we might have been rescued by the economy or rescued by college. Or this seemed to be, at the time, a kind of state of permanent dropout. Now, in the book, you talk about different members of the movements you explore ending up in the insane asylum, confronted by too many fragmentations of the personality. Can you speak about that a bit? And did you feel mentally imperiled by what was being presented to you by punk?
No, I didn't feel imperiled. I'm a fairly stable person, and I have been for a long time. But let me try and answer your question in two ways. There is no question that negationist movements, whether they're political, as the Situationists were, whether they're cultural, as Dada was, attract people who are unbalanced and often give them a field, give them a situation where they can become lucid, where they can say things other people aren't going to say, say them with more power and more beauty. And then when those movements end or when they change, often leave these people stranded back in the real world. And these people aren't able to live there. And they go nuts or they kill themselves, or they kill other people, or they simply fade away into ruins. That happens. I don't think these movements destroy people so much as they attract people who are on that path already. Maybe use them up very quickly. But in terms of my being threatened by punk, there was a moment that I write about in the book when I was at the last Sex Pistols concert in San Francisco in January 1978. And it was an extraordinarily powerful concert and a disturbing concert. I was a fan. I loved their music. I liked their records. I hadn't seen them play before. Nobody knew this was going to be their last concert, or at least none of us in the audience knew. And I remember the way the concert opened with violence, with somebody ramming through the crowd wearing a football helmet, just knocking people over, running up to someone who was in a wheelchair, knocking that person out of his wheelchair, and then the guy in the football helmet being beaten up by other members of the crowd. This is before the show even started. A lot of this was an imitation. You heard there was supposed to be violence at punk shows. But as the show went on, and as the music got stronger, and as Johnny Rotten's smile and the tear in his voice got worse, I had a moment where I was walking through Winterland, and I saw little kids, and I began to feel, you know, a really powerful malevolence. And I had an instantaneous fantasy of smashing these kids. Of course, I didn't do. And that was something that I kept hidden for a long time, that moment. And I decided to write about it in this book because I wanted to find a way to say, yeah, this stuff is dangerous. Yeah, you don't know which way this stuff is going to take you. It's nothing to fool with. This was not a moment of bragging. This was not, oh, I finally tapped in to the secret source. Nothing like that at all. It was a moment of great shame. But, you know, one of the things you have to learn how to do when you write is to say things you'd rather not say because of how people might think of you.
Well, it's very interesting because I remember when one of the first performances of PIL, Public Image Limited, was here in Los Angeles, went down to the boxing arena to see it. And I remember that the music was not doing what the audience wanted it to do. They wanted music to careen to, and this was a kind of gloom throb.
I saw a show that same week, and it exactly the same response, right.
And I do remember, you know, kids kind of pulling their way through the crowds, blood running down their face, orange, blinded by the blood, and thinking, yes, this is ecstasy. You know, there is something beautiful here. And then having to account to friends who would say, well, no, that's not ecstasy, Michael. That's, you know,
that's bad.
That's bad. That's damn bad. Kids shouldn't be doing that. And I remember, you know, I was not exposed. The 60s were not the time for me when I was listening to the music. I didn't like the music. Perhaps it wasn't as alienated as I was. That's what I finally came up with, that punk and to some extent new wave afterwards was such alienated music that I could begin to, you know, really love it. And it was odd to be talking to adults and saying, yes, it's poetry. You know, it may not be poetry as you're taught it in schools, but poetry is not poetry as you're taught it in schools. That's some substitute experience.
Absolutely.
You know, what you find that makes you passionate, and even sometimes what you find that you provoke in imitation of passion, is, you know, so valuable. I'm still, you know, taken by all sorts of moments in that scene. A friend of mine, a folk singer named Frank, was a member of the group Castration Squad. And
Frank with the PHRANC.
Right.
That Frank,
and
yeah.
She, being a Jewish lesbian folk singer, felt she had a message that she wanted to have heard, and so she played her song Take Off Your Swastikas on an acoustic guitar, almost as if the punk movement had to invent the neo-folk movement in order to comment on itself.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me so much pleasure to be seeing so many things erupt, evolve momentarily, peek their head up, and then disappear again so suddenly. That very much is the mood of this book. I guess I'm telling my listeners that in terms of cultural history, this book, which at times is quite difficult and at other times provocative and at other times just beautifully, liltingly, crazily written, does do a lot of things that pop culture does itself. It has eruptions within it. But the book does tend to define its writer. Who is the writer that this book creates? Can you describe him?
I don't know. The writer is an obsessive person obsessed with the material that he's writing about, and yet academic enough, I suppose, though I'm not an academic, to want the material that is bursting out in all directions in front of him to achieve some kind of shape, even if he's got to make that shape up. It's a writer who doesn't believe that any of this stuff is going to end well, who's basically pessimistic. And the book ends, to me anyway, with a real sense of tragedy and a real sense of loss. But it's also someone who wants to make a point, who wants to win an argument. And the argument is that distinctions between high culture and popular culture are meaningless and destructive, and that things don't have to last to be interesting, to be profound, to be vital. That something that occurs, appears, and disappears can have as great an effect on who we are, how we think, what we want, what we hate, as something that is institutionalized all around us for all of our lives. So if there's an argument in the book, or if there's a motive in the book, that's what it is. Now, that didn't answer your question, who is the writer? It's best
well, it's
I can
a,
do.
It's a difficult question because the book, presenting as it does, so many alternatives to being bored, among them, you know, going on quasi-religious crusades, developing the belief that our sins, since we are created by God, are validated by God. There are many writhing lifestyles from medieval times to the present described in the course of the book. And so the book has a kind of inciting quality that I found, you know, very pleasant and stimulating. And there is also, I remember a teacher, Irving Massey, talking about wanting a poetry that would not disgust one, stick in one's craw by its permanence, wanting a poetry that would be as ephemeral, as throwaway, as newspapers.
Right.
Just so as quick to disappear, and that we, in the society of the spectacle, want to create the hardened poetry, the poetry as object, the poem that becomes a textbook. I want to really, I guess, I feel that this interview is as, what, an attempt to come to terms with the book as the book is an attempt to come to terms with the material, and I'm really grateful for the time you've been able to spend with us. And I'm curious, what do you think, what is the effect, the after effect of punk? What's the aftershock life like?
I think there are many. There are aftershocks in the sense of there are people in countries all over the world. There are people in Poland. There are people in China. There are people in Canada. There are people in Spain who are still playing with the symbols and the hints of resistance, autonomy, and free speech that came out of punk. They're still acting them out, recapitulating them, and finding themselves, finding out who they are, what they want to be, what they want to say, in that process, in that mode. I read a marvelous article last year in the Village Voice called Punk in a Small Spanish Town, and it was about how punk came to this little, backward, almost feudal Spanish town, not in 1977, but in 1987. And this article described an almost instinctive recapitulation of politics, revolutionary politics in Spain, heresies, the experience of the Sex Pistols. Basically, my whole book was in this little article. I thought, well, I was right about this town, if nothing else.
Thank you, Grill Marcus, author of Lipstick Traces from Harvard University Press. This is Michael Silverblatt, and this has been Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books. Books, books, books.
Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.